become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Welcome to the Movie Geeks United Art of Cinematography series. Tonight's guest is Stephen Poster. Mr. Poster's beginnings in the business landed him on several legendary film sets, including Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Blade Runner. His work is astounding for many reasons, chief among them an unrivaled versatility. Just listen to some of these films. The Boy Who Could Fly, Someone to Watch Over Me, Big Top Pee Wee, Rocky V, Life Stinks, Donnie Darko, Southland Tales, and The Box. Mr. Poster is also the president of the International Cinematographers Guild.
I had been interested in photography from the time I was 10. By the time I was 12, of course, my family thought, oh, it's just another hobby. But by the time I was 12, I knew that photography was going to be my life. I didn't know what that meant, obviously, I didn't know whether I was going to be doing weddings and bar mitzvahs, and who knew, 12 years old. But I knew that I wanted to stay with photography and that I loved it, and it was something that gave me a great deal of pleasure. When I was 14, I was sitting in my living room one afternoon, and there was an empty lot next to my house in the north side of Chicago, and a man drove up in an old Jaguar, got out. I noticed the car was filled with stuff, and he got out, and he had a light meter on his belt, and I ran out of the house. He had a cap on and a beard and a smoking a pipe, and in those years, that's like... very unusual, suburbs of Chicago. And I ran outside and I said, "Hi, my name is Steve. I live next door. What kind of light meter is that?" And he said, "Son, we'll have a lot of time to talk about that. I'm building a house next door to you." And he built his house and became my mentor. He was a CBS newsreel cameraman and also owned part of the News Film Lab in Chicago. In those days, of course, news was all done on film. And he was very, very influential in my life. What he did was he insisted that I learn still photography before I ever start in movies, which I think at this point in my life was one of the best things that ever happened to me. So,
because there is definitely... Obviously, in so many positions in the film industry, and certainly cinematography, there is the technical aspect of the art form, but there's also the visual storytelling element. So you obviously had a great acuity for visual storytelling from a young age, or did you feel that way?
It's one of the reasons that attracted to me to movies, because I like telling stories. I wasn't a good writer, and the way I told stories was through pictures. So I think that's very astute of you.
Well, I'm looking over your resume, and so many of your earliest credits, when you were doing second unit work and that sort of thing, my goodness, you got off to a flying start in the industry. So many of these are just astounding credits. How did you break in? What was that first breakthrough for you?
Well, I worked in Chicago for the first, I'd say, 10 years of my career. In fact, I was finishing up my degree at the Illinois Institute of Technology at the Institute of Design, which was a great design school and a great photography school. It was the American Bauhaus. And I went in for a job as an assistant cameraman because I had already been doing that a little bit for people, and I had worked in still photography studios. I was still a senior in college, and I showed a little film that I had done in college to a man who had just recently passed away named Mike Gray, who was a wonderful documentary filmmaker and director and writer. He wrote China Syndrome, amongst other things. But at the time, we were just doing commercials. And he looked at this little film that I did and said, "Well, you know how to light." And I said, "Well, I was at Art Center in Los Angeles. I studied lighting. I've been a photographer since I was 10. Yes, I do know how to light." He said, "Well, we'll hire you as a cameraman." And I said, "Okay, I'm a cameraman." And from that point on, I think I was 21 years old, I never looked back from that, and it was a great opportunity because I was doing national commercials at 21 years old, and they wanted me because they were all cinema verite documentary people, and they weren't that concerned with lighting, but they wanted to do these national commercials, and I fit right into their scheme. So I was there. I wasn't there that long because the business kind of fell apart a bit, and they needed to get rid of me. I was low man on the totem pole, but I hung around and spent a lot of time with those guys, and some of them formed a documentary co-op called Kartemquin Films in Chicago that is still one of the longest running, oldest documentary co-ops in America, if not the world. They've been responsible for such things as Hoop Dreams and many other great documentaries. So that was kind of the crowd I was in.
Does the documentary form, is it very valuable as a training ground to kind of teach you how to think fast on your feet?
Absolutely, and of course, in those days we were carrying, you know, 40, 50 pounds of camera on our shoulders, and it was not as easy as it is today to run around with cameras constantly doing, you know, I mean, now what we have is that same format in not in cinema verite documentaries, but in reality shows, and it's a great training ground to think on your feet. It was interesting because I took a position that I wanted to bring more production value to the concept of documentaries and cinema verite. So my ability to see light really helped me in that, because I could go into a room. I developed a concept of what I call the power spot, and in every situation, every room, and every space, you can go in and you can find the most powerful spot in the room where you can really observe everything going on. And of course it's fluid, it changes at time depending on the, you know, where people move to and what's going on, but there's always a good position to see what's going on and to observe the light that's falling on people and to make the best of it and to increase the production value on some of these productions. And I'm still doing that. I mean, I just designed a webcast and documentary for the Van Cliburn piano competition. The idea that I came to that, I didn't shoot it. I was just kind of set it up and designed it. And the idea that I had there was, how do we raise the production value in a way that makes it look much more professional? And we did, and I'm very proud of that too. So I still think in those terms.
This is something that I'm curious about, because you say that there's always a perfect angle at which to capture something, but
at any given moment.
Is the trick with documentaries, though, to achieve that and yet not be too intrusive? Because if you are intrusive, it kind of breaks the reality of that situation as it's happening in some way.
Yes, but, you know, when somebody has a camera on their shoulder, there's always an influence of that camera. I think the cameras eventually become a character in the movie. You know, the camera itself becomes a character. So when I was doing my documentaries, you know, in terms of the cinema verite style, I would insinuate myself into a situation, because I don't think the camera is neutral. And sometimes I would even question the people from behind the camera as I was shooting. So I think that, you know, you can maybe someone like Frederick Weissman, you know, who does these great documentaries, can get away with being somewhat invisible. But even so, you know, because he goes in for months without film and just sits there, and people get used to him, and he gets astonishing stuff that way. But I still think that there is some influence that the camera must have.
Sure. So in these early years, did you have opportunities to observe and study how people like Vilmos or Mr. Cronenwith, how they worked?
Oh, of course. What a great opportunity. These were tremendous opportunities for me. On Close Encounters, when I got that, there was a division in the unions, the labor unions in the film business, and that division was that there were three territories in America that were different unions or different locals of the same union. And because of that, there were rules that if somebody came from California, they had to have someone from the central region, what we call the Chicago region at that time, to match them. So on Close Encounters, for instance, I was hired to match Vilmos just as a body. It was kind of an interesting situation. It doesn't exist today, because now we are, all three locals are one local 600, the International Cinematographers Guild. So that doesn't happen the same way. You don't put standbys on. So I was kind of hired as the Chicago standby, and the first few weeks I was there, Steven Spielberg didn't even let me touch a camera. And finally, one day, he said, "All right, we're shooting the party scene in the backyard of these suburban houses in Mobile, Alabama," and he said, "Take a camera out and show me what you can do." And from that point on, I was part of the production team, and I was able to do an awful lot of stuff for them and become the second unit director of photography on Close Encounters.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
And in fact, I had my first day as a grown-up DP on Close Encounters, because Vilmos had been, his crew had been rigging the big set, the dirigible hangar that was, or it was a C-47 hangar from World War II. It was a huge, huge interior space, and they had been working on this this set and the lighting of it, the rigging of it, for 4 months. And they wanted Vilmos to just walk in and start shooting. And he said, I can't do that. I need to get in there and spend a little time turning lights on and aiming them. And they said, well, we can't stop production for that. So, what they did was they figured he would never agree to this. Was the evacuation scene where there were throngs of people and a train and herds of chickens and cows and horses and I had a Titan crane and I had arc lights and things, tools that I had never really used before, but I managed to accomplish that day, and that was my first day as a grown-up DP. And of course, the confusion became that the director was named Steven, and I was named Steven. So every time somebody would say, you know, Steven, we would both turn around. It was kind of a funny situation, but that was
wow.
It. And I never looked back.
What a massive undertaking! I mean, to be in the middle of that atmosphere. I've heard the kind of the horror stories about trying to light that massive set. It's really impressive. I want to ask you about one of your earliest films that you were the director of photography on, and that's Someone to Watch Over Me, which is a Ridley Scott's film.
Yep.
And of course, he is one of the most visually splendid directors out there. And this movie feels like a noir. Did you apply those visual techniques in this film?
Yeah, let me tell you about Ridley. Ridley came out of art direction and commercials, and his main thrust was art direction, and brilliant at that, absolutely brilliant. So, in the photography side, he was a collaborator, really gave me a tremendous amount of freedom, as long as I could keep up with him. He's an amazing thinker. He has an amazing mind, and he would come in and give you an idea for a setup, and then you could do something that. And show him, and then he would kind of modify it a little bit, and then you could modify it a little bit, and it was a wonderful collaboration in that sense. And he gave me because he had met me on Blade Runner when I was doing additional photography for him, which is also an interesting story of how I got that. He gave me a tremendous amount of freedom and the ability to collaborate with him as long as I could think as fast as he did. Mm. So,
is there in a film of that style, that kind of noir style, it really deals heavily, as that genre of films do, with definitely light and shadow in a very special way. Do you apply maybe techniques that were used in black and white photography to the color photography in that film?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think that the two are very are not separated in my mind. And in fact, today most of my in fact almost all of my still photography is black and white. I'm also an art photographer and have had museum shows and gallery shows around the country, but it's all black and white. So in today's world, when you shoot digitally, even though you're going to end up in black and white, you shoot color, and you convert it to black and white. There happens to be one camera now that is a pure black and white digital camera. But in fact, most of the time you're shooting color, thinking in black and white. So to me, it's not that different, you know, because I'm seeing the picture in my mind as black and white, even though we're shooting color. So I don't think that it's a matter of being able to see light. That's the key. you know, you can teach someone how to where to put lights and everything, but they're not, you're not going to teach them how to see light. You have to learn how to see light.
You've done a fair share of comedy work as well.
I know, I love comedy.
And everyone I talk to from all different kinds of disciplines, whether it be acting or directing or writing, they all talk about how tricky comedy is. Is it equally tricky to photograph?
I think it, you know, it's doing it well, I think is every bit as hard as doing any kind of drama. I never liked the idea that, oh, comedy is bright. You know, and it's not that you're going to do a noir comedy. You really, you know, do have to approach it differently. But I think that there is every bit of aesthetic in terms of the lighting as there would be for any other kind of movie. And in fact, if you look at some of the comedies that I've done that I think are the most successful, like for instance, Life Stinks with Mel Brooks. Mm-hmm. It has a much more distinctive look than those studio comedies that just say, well, light it up, let them see it. And I think that, in fact, that you choose, when I start on a project, I kind of want to go through all my testing and developing of ideas and technical stuff and get that out of the way. And then I want to shoot intuitively. And the intuition that I have is telling stories with light and composition and movement. And that takes over whether or not it's a style that fits with the... it always has to fit with what the director wants in terms of telling the story, and it has to fit with what the production can afford. But of course, my job has always been, even from the earliest part of my career, as I said, is to bring more production value to something, no matter what the cost is, no matter what the budget is. Work within that budget to trick people into much better production value than they thought they could have in the first place. it's kind of my game. And in fact, I have a method of working with directors that that I've developed over the years. And as I said, I want to eliminate the technical from my thinking and just work intuitively. One of the very first movies that I did that I feel was completely successful in that method was Donnie Darko. I took that job because of the script. I thought the script was brilliant, and Richard was I think around 23 at the time, and I said, I will do this movie under the condition that Richard and I can have 3 or 4 days alone together talking about the script. And they agreed to that. And when we started that process, I, of course, walked in the room and I noticed that Richard was kind of nervous and pacing around a bit. And I said, wait a minute, stop a second. Okay, from this point on, you and I are the same age. You don't consider that I am, you know, more experienced or anything there. I am just here to help you tell the story. And I could noticeably see him relax, and we started getting into it, and we read the script to each other in ways that we totally broke it all down in our minds as to what story we wanted to tell with every scene. What did we want the audience to understand? I believe that every frame of every movie informs the audience, and when you have that concept, you have to think about what it is you're telling the audience with every image. And it's worked very well for me. It worked very well on Donnie Darko, and it's worked on every other movie since then.
Well, and your work with Mr. Kelly has afforded you an obvious freedom of experimentation. These each of these films, they present their own unique challenges, and they're all just incredibly stunning to watch. I know one of our co-hosts, one of his very favorite movies is Southland Tales. And
I love hearing that. I love that movie, and it's so misunderstood.
Yes.
It really is. It was an absurdist political commentary that was not sold that way, and I think it was a huge mistake.
If you could just quickly speak about the challenges unique to Southland Tales and something like The Box, which is a movie that I really adore and has a very special feeling, that movie. What were the challenges unique to those for you?
Well, on Southland Tales, it was a kind of homage to those kind of beach movies, you know, in the sense that it really all took place within that you know, kind of sunny Southern California, you know, beach. Nothing bad can happen in that kind of light, you know. But in fact, it was. it was a very interesting. We shot that. We did that movie in 27 days. And now, for anybody who knows movie schedules, that was very, very fast for the amount of stuff that we did. Like, for instance, the scene that was the music video, with Justin Timberlake, the producers said to us, "You can't do that. You'll never do it in time. It's going to ruin the production. You don't have the time to do that. Stop. Don't even think of doing that." And we said, "Give us 3 hours." And in 3 hours, we created that whole thing.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and if you go back and look at it, it's only four shots. four or five. So we really pulled off, you know, kind of miracles on that movie for no money at all, and it was a great challenge to do it, and great fun. And Richard and I think so much alike in terms of that kind of storytelling. And in fact, in The Box, this was our first digital movie together. And we wanted to find a way to not make it a digital movie, but make it a movie that nobody thought about how it was shot. And I had to develop a look based on that, and also a look that was a period look. So that was a great challenge and a lot of fun to do. And of course, working with Cameron Diaz, how hard is that?
Yeah, quite photogenic, that Cameron Diaz. Yes, absolutely. And it's a stunning-looking movie.
By the way, let me just give you one aside. We're about to start our fourth movie together.
Are you really?
And I think we're just waiting for the green light. I think it's the best script he's ever written.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, the true crime story. It's really terrific.
You are the president of the International Cinematographers Guild.
Yes,
what does that entail?
A lot of politics. No, it really is an honor. I've always felt that part of my job in this lifetime is protecting in advancing the art and craft of cinematography. And this is the International Cinematographers Guild is a trade union, like any others, like, you know, plumbers or pipe fitters or carpenters. We are a trade union. And in fact, we're probably the most unionized industry in America today. And our union is growing, unlike most unions, and it's very successful in that sense. We protect and guarantee good lives for our members. We protect them by having developing and demanding absolute safe conditions. Because it's only a movie, we don't want to hurt anybody. I mean, it's a dangerous business. we guarantee that people can develop a career and have a pension and welfare and health care and all of the protections that a labor union or trade union is supposed to afford us. And we have 7,000 members across the country, which consists of directors of photography, camera operators, camera assistants, digital imaging technicians, still photographers, and we even have the publicist, the movie publicist, with us. So we have a great depth of membership all across the country. And we're a very active and involved union. So my job as president, I believe, is threefold: is to continue to develop the protections of a trade union that any trade union would have. It's also, as I said, to protect and advance the art and craft of cinematography. And to look out for the welfare of my members. I'm very vocal, and I write a lot, and I speak a lot at events, because I believe we're in the most disruptive period of the art of and craft of telling stories with movies that's ever existed. Even sound was not this disruptive. I'm not saying disruptive as a negative. I'm just saying that, you know, it's a disruptive moment in because everything is changing and everything has changed, and we need to maintain the ability to do our work in ways that does not, you know, because it's so easy to pick up a camera and say, okay, I'm a director of photography now.
Right, right.
You know, but in fact, it's much more complicated than that. You know, and I think what we are doing is we're developing our own best practices in terms of working digitally. Computing power, software, and development and hardware development have gotten to a point where we can now do all of the front-end laboratory work on the set cheaper, better, and faster than by the traditional ways of sending the film into the laboratory and waiting for it till the next day. We can do that all on the set and do it cheaper and faster and better than any of the facilities that exist. So it's a matter of developing those jurisdictions and maintaining them.
Well, you're protecting the integrity of the art form, and I would think, as you said, that it's that poses a specific challenge now, since cinematography has become so democratized through this new technology. So that,
you know,
that's
I love
incredible
that.
Work.
I love that word because in fact it's democratized because it's cheaper to buy a camera, but in fact it still takes the same amount of skill and ability and intuitive nature to be able to tell stories.